The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
The plan for me is always learning, find new opportunities, and never limit yourself. I am always learning. I am always trying to find new opportunities. If you can say that you can do that, I think there's nothing to be scared of.
Hello, and welcome to Stephanomics, the podcast that brings the global economy to you. What you heard there was the voice of youthful optimism, 20-year-old Panis from Bangkok. For most of the past 50 years, that optimism would have been well-founded. Any young person growing up in one of the fast-growing Asian economies could expect to end up comfortably better off than their parents. But it doesn't feel that way for those just entering the jobs market in 2020. The pandemic has hit job prospects for young people in Asia hardest of all. They're calling it the lockdown generation. And Bloomberg senior Asia economy correspondent Ender Curran is going to tell us all about them a little later. But this week I also wanted to give you a sneak preview of some smart analysis we've been pulling together for Bloomberg's New Economy Forum, which will be entirely online this year, but starts on November 16th. All the Bloomberg economists have been put to work on this. Later on we'll hear Eurozone economist Maeve Cousin tell us about a project she's done looking at how climate change could affect the global economy under different scenarios. But first, our chief economist, Tom Orlick, great friend of the podcast, is here to give us an overview of this special report. Tom, I've got the report in my hands, hot off the presses. It's going to be available on the Bloomberg New Economy Forum website any minute now, which is a rare treat for those of you who don't usually get to see Bloomberg's economic research. There's so much here, but I wanted to focus, Tom, on your projections for what the world could look like in 2050. You're a brave man looking that far ahead. But if you step back with that kind of long-term view, I guess you can get to the nub of the big forces driving the global economy. What different scenarios did you think about?
Well, Stephanie, let's keep in mind that I just published a book called China, the Bubble That Never Pops. So clearly you're talking to someone who's not afraid of leaving hostages to fortune. So we're looking out to the world in 2050, and clearly there's a huge amount that could change between now and then. And we're seeing in 2020 how a pandemic can shape the trajectory for major economies. But what we've done is we've used a growth accounting framework. So we've looked at how demographics is going to change. We've looked at the likely pathway for capital spending and for productivity growth. And by doing that, we've put together baseline forecasts for GDP growth out over the next three decades. And then we've layered on top of those scenarios for some of the mega trends, globalization, climate change, and how they could shape the outlook.
So one of the pieces you did, I guess it's a familiar story in a sense, the shift in economic power from west to east that we expect to see happen in that time. And but the numbers are quite significant.
Yeah, so for the last 70 years, there's been a period of really remarkable stability in the sort of the economic balance of power. We've had the US and Europe firmly in the driving seat, and the intellectual consensus has been centered around the benefits of free markets and the power of democracies to drive economic dynamism. Now, in the last 15, 20 years, we've seen the beginning of a transition. China is rising. India are coming up behind them. So what our forecasts show is that this is really just the beginning of the transition. And in the next 30 years, we're going to see China, India, other Asian emerging markets like Indonesia rising up the global rankings. By the time we get to 2050, China will firmly be in the number one spot. India, we think, will be number three and closing the gap with the United States. And Indonesia could well be up in the big league as well. Now, as that happens, it's not just a geographical shift, right? It's not just a shift from west to east. It's also a shift from advanced economies to emerging markets. And it's a shift from economies which operate on a free market principle to economies like China and, in a different way, India, that have a much higher degree of state intervention.
And that's actually, that is a very, very striking. So what's the numbers there in terms of the share of the global economy that's, if you like, in democratic hands versus non-democratic, and how does that change?
So what we've done is we've interacted our forecasts with the classifications of different societies by Freedom House. And Freedom House classify societies into free, so that's kind of a functioning democracy, partly free, so that's a society which has some democratic aspects, but you wouldn't characterize it as a fully functioning economy, and not free, so that's single party states. And so when we interact our forecasts with those social classifications, what we see is that the share of the global economy, which is controlled by free democracies, is going to shrink from around 86% in 2000 to around 60% in 2050. And the share which is controlled by partly free and not free societies is going to rise all the way up from about 14% to about 40%. So a huge shift in the sort of the geographical composition of the global economy, the sort of the share of the global economy that's classified as free market versus state interventionist, but also that political shift as well. A much larger share of global output is going to be coming from non-democratic states.
And you've spent a lot of time in China. I mean, it is quite, I wonder whether you think that the way that China has responded to the COVID threat could make even these projections turn out to be an underestimate of China's, what China's standing is going to be in a few years' time. I mean, many people think they have vaulted several years ahead of the West by being able to manage this crisis so effectively at a time when particularly the US and Britain was really floundering.
Right. So one of the things that could throw these projections off are a major crisis, right? A lot of people look at China and they think there's a big financial crisis coming down the road because China's taken on so much debt. And if that happens, clearly it would put a dent in China's growth trajectory. What we've seen in 2020, though, as you know, is this global pandemic, catastrophic impact across major economies. But China has really come out of it first and come out of it fastest. So our forecast is for 2% growth in China this year. We think they'll come back to 8% growth next year. No other major economy is going to do so well. So ironically, even though the COVID crisis started in China, when we come out of it, it could well be that China has accelerated that process of narrowing the gap with the United States.
Now, one view of at least part of what the Trump administration has been doing the last few years, and we've reported so much on this podcast, is he was trying to fight the kind of arithmetic and dynamic that you've just outlined. He's trying to make sure that the US didn't fall behind in terms of its share of global economy in quite the same way that you've described. I mean, is there anything that the so-called West, the US and Western Europe, can do to change the outcome in 2050 in a sort of serious way?
Yeah, so there's a phrase which you often see in Chinese policy documents, Banhao Zijida She. It sort of roughly translates as do your own work well, right? The last 4 years have really been a period where the US has focused on attacking China, right? Let's put tariffs up. Let's make it harder to sell technologies to China. Let's try and break up big Chinese internet companies. There hasn't been a lot of investment in US education, a lot of investment in US infrastructure, a lot of investment in US research and development. Now, if the US wants to do its own work well and accelerate growth at home, then I think a sort of a smart strategy would be to continue that advocacy for sort of a level playing field, free markets globally, but also make those investments which drive growth potential at home as well.
It's almost a shame that we haven't got President Trump doing his next summit with the Chinese leader to be told, do your own work well. I think that would go down extremely well. We should just touch on the other piece of this research, which was looking at the impact over a 30-year timeframe of of less globalization, or indeed a reversal of globalization. There's been so much talk about that in the wake of both Donald Trump's trade policies, but also the COVID pandemic. What did you find there, and what were you looking at?
So it's not just US-China relations which are breaking down, right? We have Brexit, the UK stepping away from its trade relationship with the European Union. We have COVID-era concern about control of supply chains. Countries which in the first half of this year could make their own masks and make their own antibiotics and make their own ventilators were in a better position than countries which were sourcing those from overseas. So there's a global trend towards deglobalization. That is potentially a very serious problem for global growth. A world where global trade and technology and financial ties start to splinter is going to be a smaller world than a world where they continue to strengthen. And it also has distributional consequences. Globalization is good for all countries, but it's especially good for emerging markets which are aiming to export their way to prosperity and catch up rapidly to the global technology frontier. So we explored a couple of scenarios, one where global ties continue to strengthen and one where global ties splinter back to the level in 2000, just before China joined the WTO, just as Europe was creating its single currency. The consequences of that for the difference between those two scenarios for global growth is really enormous. The negative impact of deglobalization is much more severe for those emerging markets, places like China, places like Vietnam.
And I was going to ask you that. So who are the biggest losers? Are those countries, I guess, who would have otherwise done the best on the integration scenario?
Yeah, it's the Asian emerging markets. It's China, it's Vietnam, a bit further up the development spectrum, it's Korea. It's the countries that have done the best from gaining global export market share and absorbing foreign technologies. They're the biggest winners from globalization. They'd be the biggest losers if globalization now spins into reverse.
Tom Wallach, thank you very much.
Great to be here, Stephanie.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Well, we're not assuming that globalization will go into reverse, but the COVID crisis has given young people in Asia a taste of a world in which all the economic opportunities have suddenly dried up. They're calling it the lockdown generation. Bloomberg's Enda Curran has more.
Here in Hong Kong, while the pandemic is under control, the economy remains in recession. Unemployment is at a 15-year high, and youth unemployment has surged during the crisis. Of course, the story of youth unemployment is playing out across the Asia region, a part of the world that is home to a majority of those aged 15 to 24. It's why the Asian Development Bank and International Labour Organization are warning of a lockdown generation. We reached out to young people and experts across the region to gauge how deep this jobs crisis is. Vincent Lau, aged 20, is among those in Hong Kong who's unemployed and looking for work, in his case, possibly as a waiter.
It's really hard to find a job right now. When pandemic comes in, a lot of companies start to firing the employee, and I'm kind of afraid about not getting a job because I don't think they're going to hire too much people. Yeah, I'm not expecting to get a job very soon.
I spoke with Felix Weidenkauf of the International Labour Organization, who is based in Bangkok.
So the COVID-19 pandemic has led to a massive disruption to the economies and labour markets in Asia Pacific. And we found that they have disproportionate impacts on youth employment, now threatening to create a lockdown generation.
The region's fast-growing economies for decades have offered millions of young people the chance to do better than their parents, a path to upward mobility now at risk as youth unemployment soars. Young people are losing jobs at a faster rate than older generations because almost half are clustered in the four economic sectors hurt most by the COVID-19 pandemic: wholesale and retail, manufacturing, business services, and accommodation and food. Young women and the poorest are hardest hit.
And there are several underlying factors why youth in Asia Pacific are particularly vulnerable. Asia in the Pacific region is home to the majority of the world's young people aged 15 to 24. And as such, their contribution is key to the region's productivity and also inclusive development.
Panasoom Prapan is a 20-year-old from Bangkok who wanted to turn his love of aviation into a career by studying aerospace engineering. Those plans are now far from certain after COVID halted much of global air travel.
The pandemic just like changed everything that I had thought about my career, because aviation was supposed to be one of those industries that was growing substantially before COVID. And I thought that Thailand is kind of like the central hub of Asia. So I figured it might be good if I pursue this career path.
While Panas is hopeful that the aviation sector eventually gets back in the air, he's also looking at his options.
If aviation was not possible, I have also considered other fields of engineering, like the energy field, which I already sent some applications to. So this is my alternative plan right now.
The impact goes beyond headline rates of unemployment. Professor Weijun Jin-Yung, founding director of the Center for Family and Population Research at the National University of Singapore, warns that this crisis will strain relations with older generations. It puts young people's mental health at risk and is shaping up to be worse than previous jobs crises.
And it's not just youth unemployment. There's the underemployment. People who cannot find jobs settle for something less well paid and work fewer hours. There's also people who got discouraged of looking for jobs that becomes idled. So there are various ways that this pandemic is making the impact of economic recession much worse than young people, in a way that's much worse than any other age groups.
She highlights the impact on younger women, especially, who are forced into unpaid labor at home as they fall out of the workforce.
You know, on women, this is particularly hard. Many of them would just become someone in the statistics that are not in employment, education, or training because of the labor market, but also because of unpaid work demand at home.
Even in China, where the economic recovery is most advanced, the government has warned that the jobless rate among young workers remains high. In Japan, companies are cutting back on hiring and new graduates are losing their chance for long-term employment. Zhu Yue recently completed her internship at a big tech company in Beijing and is now in Japan, where she plans to finish her postgraduate studies. She's hoping for a job in media or digital content at some of China's technology giants, but she's already noticed that there are fewer roles on offer. When she first graduated in 2018, jobs were plentiful.
Compared with right now, I think the competition is much fiercer than before, because there are so many graduates who should have found a job in 2020 but didn't. Before the start of my job hunting, I planned to apply for some positions in some internet companies. This year, I found that this kind of job not available anymore.
The COVID-19 shock is creating a class of new poor across East Asia and the Pacific. According to the World Bank, 38 million more people will be living in poverty in 2020. To counter long-term scouring, Weidenkopf at the ILO says governments need to pour money into education and skills training.
The pathways that a lot of young people might have taken when in Asia Pacific when they entered the labor market, that is now being disrupted, because that used to be in sectors that are now most impacted, such as the wholesale and retail trade and manufacturing. Governments need to adopt and implement immediate large-scale and targeted measures to stimulate economy and youth employment. Essentially, that has to do with the fact that it is now critical to prioritize youth employment if you want the region to come out with more inclusive and sustainable growth. And the concern we have at this stage is that this will have long-lasting impacts and the current crisis on the labor market outcomes of youth in the region. We know from the previous financial crisis in Asia and the Pacific that the youth unemployment rate never recovered to pre-global financial crisis level of 2007. What is different now is the crisis due to COVID-19 is much more widespread on both the labor demand and supply side.
When I interviewed young people for this podcast, I was struck by their optimism that this crisis will pass eventually. Many, like Panas Umprapan, say that they want to be ready to embrace whatever opportunities comes along. It's a hopeful note in an uncertain time.
The plan for me is always learning, find new opportunities and never limit yourself. Maybe the plan I thought about the energy, like renewable energy, might not work for the next month, next years, whatever. But I am always learning. I am always trying to find new opportunities. If you can say that you can do that, I think there's nothing to be scared of.
For Bloomberg News, I'm Enda Curran.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I mentioned that our Eurozone economist, Maeva Cousin, who's been on the podcast a few times, had contributed a climate piece to this special New Economy Forum report. She worked with the chief EMEA economist, Jamie Rush, on this project. But Maeva, tell me briefly what you did and some of the broad brush conclusions.
Yes, thanks. So we've looked at the cost of climate change, not just the physical cost of climate change, but also the cost of transitioning to a low carbon economy to avoid those physical costs from climate change. And so we've used the scenarios developed by the NGFS, the Network of Central Banks for Greening the Financial Sector. And we've focused on three main scenarios. One is a do-nothing scenario. It's a hot planet scenario. It's a case where policies simply continue as they are now, no more. And that would mean having temperature rising to about probably 2 degrees above pre-industrial times by 2050 and 4 degrees by 2100. And then there are two transition scenarios along the lines of the Paris Agreement, so to cap temperature at 2 degrees Celsius. And that would one orderly scenario that starts now and is gradual and gives time for the technology to mature, and one disorderly scenario, which is delayed until 2030. And then we looked at the different trajectories for different countries, which allowed us to estimate the costs for various countries rather than just globally.
There's lots here, and it's hard to go into the details, because then there'll be lots of people nitpicking at it. I did notice one big thing, which is obviously also quite worrying when you think about the political economy of this, is some of the biggest economies, the ones that we look to now and we know are going to be really important for this effort, are ones that will not benefit from the mitigation efforts for quite a long time. So you've got them having to spend quite a lot of money, or at least sacrifice a certain amount of growth for some period before they get to see the benefits of that cooler planet.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the problem is that the costs of climate change, the physical costs, the chronic costs from hotter temperatures are quite slow moving, and it's difficult to disentangle them, to really notice them. And they become more and more important. But according to these scenarios, they did already cost us about 1% of GDP as of today. So if the world was not so hot already, we would be maybe 1% higher GDP. And then by 2050, they estimate around 3% extra, 2% extra cost, so a cost of 3% in total. And then 10% by 2100. But these are central costs, these are chronic costs. There are, of course, a lot of uncertainty. It could be in these estimates, they go up to maybe 25% cost by 2100. So there's this big uncertainty on the costs of climate change, and the fact that they are gradually increasing, and maybe there will be a tipping point where they start increasing even faster. The cost of transition are more front-loaded. So a lot of the transition costs would happen at the start of the transition. Even in the orderly transition, they would be around 2% by 2050 estimated, and then they would go up to maybe 3-4% by 2100. So they are very much front-loaded. And what happens is that the focus being on the next 30 years, it looks cheaper globally to do nothing than to start the transition. But of course, by 2100. And so it means that globally, the break-even, where it becomes cheaper to do something than do nothing, is around 2069, which is already quite late in terms of global GDP today. But then if you look at the US or the EU, it's more like 2090, 2100. For short-sighted policymakers, and you don't have to be, I mean, even quite long-sighted ones, we are talking about 70 years ahead. And that's a big challenge. If there was a central planner, we would probably, I think we would have started quite a long time ago, actually. But in those current circumstances, the coordination is a key challenge.
But to be clear, it's not saying that it only makes sense to do something in 2070. It's just that it won't be evident. You won't be able to say right now that the costs are less than the benefits until yes. 2070. The final thing I noticed in this research, Maver, which I think would worry some incoming members of the Biden administration who have put the climate, you know, high on there, they've named it as one of their four priorities, is that you show that if the more aggressive the US is in embracing the climate agenda, the quicker it will be before China overtakes the US. So it sounds like Donald Trump was right.
So in a way, that's right, because the more disruptive costs of climate change or the disruptive costs of a disorderly transition will be felt more in some parts of the world and less generally in advanced economies. either because they are less reliant on fossil fuels or they have better capacities of adjusting. China has quite a lot of a lot of the productivity is in very urban areas where the cost of climate change from floods, from very heavy rain in particular, could be quite high. So that makes them quite sensitive. The estimates we have at the moment is 4% cost by 2050 for China, where it's less than, I think it's probably less than 1% for the US and most advanced economies. So that's right that the generally emerging economies would benefit more. From
America's efforts. I mean, from
everybody's effort to move to an orderly transition. That's right.
Well, much to think about, and let's hope that the incoming Biden administration don't focus too much on those long-term scenarios. You get the impression that they're looking past those kind of narrow assessments, at least for now. Maeva Cousin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Stephanomics. We'll be back next week with the Bloomberg New Economy Forum, where I'll be discussing, among other things, the future of central banking with a blockbuster panel of Larry Summers, Janet Yellen, Raghuram Rajan, and Lord Mervyn King. In the meantime, remember you can always find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website, app, or wherever you get your podcasts. And for more news and analysis from Bloomberg Economics, follow @economics on Twitter. This episode was produced by Magnus Hendrickson, with special thanks to Ender Curran, Maeva Cousin, and Tom Orlick. Lucy Meakin is the executive producer of Stephanomics, and the head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.